Hello, everyone, and welcome to Now Spinning, the official podcast of the Lansing Community College Vinyl Record Club. We meet twice a month to listen to vinyl and talk about music. Stay tuned to learn about how you can get in touch with us and attend our meetings. Today, we are going to be talking about the meeting that we held on
April Fool's Day.
Yeah, April 1st, 2025. But first, let's introduce our people here. Today, we have
Tyler Reck,
Noah Miller.
My name was. Simon Medina, let's get started right in here with the first song that was played at this meeting, though, which is Telstar by the Tornadoes.
Yeah, I found it like the Friday before, and I've been searching for this thing for 2 years. First time I ever heard it was in a diner up in Mackinac City, and it like dang near struck me to the ground. I was like, heard it, and I was like, this is amazing. I still think it is pretty amazing because Telstar was a satellite that could broadcast video transmissions across the Atlantic. Like, so somebody in London could watch JFK giving a speech or something.
Nice.
That was like the big thing, you know, in telecommunications and stuff.
It's very ahead of its time, I think, like the instrumental.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty fun. It's got like this kind of like driving like synth.
Yeah, it's very retro, but like at the same time, like it's a new, very... Like with like you said, like with the synth sound, like that's very forward thinking for what 1960
yeah.
No, 62.
Yeah, this is super early, really early.
Like I think it's the first British invasion song is what it's classified as.
Fascinating instrumental though. I like that song. Yeah. However, second song we have here. Yeah, somebody played Never Gonna Give You Up, which I wasn't there for, so everybody else at Record Club except for me got Rickrolled. I'm happy about that. Rick Astley came in.
Rick Astley spawned.
Friend of the show, Rick Astley came in, dropped to 45, played Never Gonna Give You Up, disappeared into thin air. No one knows who did it. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that's a song. Anyway, moving on, we have Fugazi, The Waiting Room.
Yeah.
Not The Waiting Room, just Waiting Room.
Yeah, so this is the first song off of their first album. And it was their biggest song in their catalog. Fugazi, like post-hardcore punk band, kind of late 80s sort of stuff. Off of this album, it was just kind of called seven songs. The version on Spotify is 13. There's like a couple like extra bonus tracks and stuff like that. But this one has the track Suggestion on it, which was another big track off of that one. And this album kind of culminates in the 15 minutes of fame that they had. Suggestion is kind of, it's standing against like objectification, just kind of at large from kind of a woman's perspective. But Ian MacKaye just has this really, like drill sergeant-esque like delivery to the lines that he gives. And Guy Picciotto, I think that's how you would pronounce his last name. He's just a great counter voice to Ian in that band. And yeah, just the whole album and the production of it is very clean. I mean, let alone being their first album, but just kind of a punk album in general. It's very clean, but there's still like some rough edges to it and stuff. It's a lot of fun.
I have to check that out. I put that on my list. I definitely would listen to that. It was a great song.
Yeah.
The list is very long, but it's on there.
Yeah.
Somewhere.
Next is I Could Be So Good to You by Don and the Good Times. This is a very good sunshine poppy kind of song. I found it in a dollar bin. I really like it, and I decided to play it because, you know, it's kind of the lots of later 60s, like late 60s bands kind of had that whole one hit wonder sort of thing.
It's like a doo-wop kind of like almost kind of shuffle thing going on in here with some early rock stuff going too.
Yeah.
Really, really good harmonies on it too.
Yeah.
As well.
Speaking of one hit wonders, we've got two big ones in a row here. We have Wham Bam Shang-a-Lang by Silver, which you know that song.
Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
I don't remember the bit in the movie. I remember it's in that movie. You know. I forget where it was. Then... Along with Wham Bam Shang-a-Lang, we have My Sharona by The Knack, which is like probably the one of the biggest one-hit wonders. Everybody like immediately will jump to it when you say that word, like that phrase. It's, you know, The Knack. Tyler, you mentioned that I've said that I really, really hate this album cover because it's just staring into the depths of my soul.
Yeah, the lead guy. This just, I guess, goes to show you how much of a one-hit wonder The Knack is. I don't even know any of their names, but the guy in the second, like, from left to right, the second guy is just staring at you.
Yeah, I don't like that.
Like, just pull up a picture of the album right now and look.
Don't look, it'll scare you. Yeah, I mean, this is a very good power pop song. I mean, when you like, this is basically, it's like archetypal one-hit wonder, archetypal power pop song. Quite good. very catchy. Like, once you hear it, it doesn't leave your head. Those two songs are both, like I said, super catchy. That's why they're hits, that you can't get them out of your head. Yeah. It's dangerous.
Yeah. Back to Wham Bam Shang Lang. Two things about that one.
Whiplash.
Yeah. With that one, I believe that was the band's only album, right?
Pretty sure, yeah.
Because it doesn't show anything else on Spotify except some random trap thing apparently they're connected to.
Huh.
But this song definitely, it's kind of like it's Steely Dan meets disco. That's kind of the vibe that I really got from it. And just the strings, the hits in there, a lot of fun.
It's very lush. It's a beautiful song. Moving forward, Tyler, do you have anything to say about it?
Over, under, sideways, down is by the Yardbirds.
By the Yardbirds.
I had Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page, and some other guy. But it's really cool, a really cool song.
It's very good.
It's like really like kind of grooving and driving and all that stuff. And now on to the ninth song that we played.
Welcome Home by Coheed and Cambria, which did make an appearance in the trailer for the movie Nine. It was a Tim Burton produced movie. He didn't actually like direct it, or it wasn't really his vision. I'm blanking on the main guy's name right now. I'm very sorry, but
it'll come to you.
Maybe. Well, one can hope. But anyway, Welcome Home. This also made kind of a big appearance in Rock Band, the Rock Band game series. Just mostly, I think, for the dueling guitar lines at the end and the riff at the beginning. This song gets compared to Kashmir by Led Zeppelin quite a bit, mostly for the verse riff and everything, and kind of the way that it progresses. But yeah, not really cool. Really cool album in general. I've mentioned it on the show before. Coheed and Cambria, they got comics that go along with their albums too. Yeah, just really good alternative prog rock. Yeah,
definitely check them out.
Yeah. Next, we have a song from a choreographer called Mickey.
Yeah, Hey Mickey, that's the song.
Yeah. And next up, we have we have Little Darlin' by the Diamonds, which is a really good 50s song.
Yeah, that was very...
Like, which I kind of feel bad for 50s stuff. Like, I love 50s stuff, and sometimes people are like, oh, all of it sounds the same, you know, nobody remembers that. And I'm like, eh, not really. And if you listen to the playlist, it'll kind of prove my point.
Like, yeah, you do tend to bring some... I will say I do tend to subscribe to that, but you definitely bring like some stuff that, you know, is different from that like standard 50s sound.
There's
some deep cuts and
couple
really cool
things
stuff.
That I played that we're going to talk about later that are kind of funny.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it just was 50s music, I guess. It's just that you know, artists didn't have the level of like freedom of expression they would get in like the 60s and later, like even into the 70s and 80s. Like everything was very like... It was very, you couldn't really be an indie musician in like the 50s as much, like, you know, everything's very corporate control. Yeah. But that doesn't mean you know.
It's not all the exact same.
No, yeah, it's
you
just,
know, like,
it's
like
the more interesting
Chuck
stuff. It's
Chuck Berry and like another like 50s artist, like the Crest or something, they sound completely different.
Well, yeah, it's just the genres, I guess. I mean, not to say like the 50s is like a bad decade for music, like, you know, compared to it laid the foundations for everything that came after it, obviously. Like, it's not going to like, a lot of it's not going to hold up to like what it inspired, obviously, but to like, you know, you shouldn't discount the whole decade just because it doesn't
hit
the same level of sophistication as like, you know, like later, like 70s, 60s rock stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it all builds up, you know, it's good to see where it came from, you know, it makes sense to you. Anyway, that rant aside.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting list. It's a 70s song by the band Pink Floyd.
Who?
I don't. They're never.
No, they're the one that did. They're the one that did Another Brick in the Wall and didn't have any other hits, right? I mean, I looked on Spotify. That song. Well, jokes aside, that was the whole like joke.
Yeah.
Another Brick in the Wall has like over 1 billion streams on Spotify, and it's their most well-known song. And, you know, everybody knows Pink Floyd, so, you know, what...
I think that it's a good song.
Yeah.
This was kind of
grooving.
This was kind of the peak, I want to say, of just kind of their energy. I don't want to say it's like I don't want to...
I mean...
I don't want to definitively say it was, like, their best album, like, hands down, although a lot of people would probably agree with that. This was kind of their peak just in creative energy, I would say, because they had the album, they had the movie, and then later on, like, they started doing, like, stage productions of The Wall, and then they had the whole tour and stuff around that.
Yeah, are you talking about, like, The Wall, like, afterwards, or are you talking about, like, Roger Waters, the Wall
they had
live.
They toured it in the '70s with the whole Pink Floyd band, not just Roger Waters.
And they they did it in the '90s, like literally less than a year after the Berlin Wall fell. Mm. And he did it like in the zone right in between where the walls were.
Okay.
And he like played the entirety of the Wall.
That was powerful.
Yeah. Huh.
But
that's a good song.
I listened to that and I was like, okay, I haven't listened to The Wall in like 12 years. I'm going to listen to it again.
I've been listening to it a lot lately.
Andy. Yeah. Andy brought it.
But if you're going to play part two, you need to play Happiest Days of Our Lives, which we did at the meeting. So
yeah. Oh, what the heck?
Yeah. I didn't put that on there because it was like, you know, just a little snippet of it. Yeah. So I don't really see a point, you know, to talk, let's talk about Happiest Days of Our Lives and another brick in the wall.
It is kind of two sides of the same coin. I just kind of consider it as like an intro to another brick in the wall.
Yeah.
It's like its own separate
thing. Just like a little bit of Empty Spaces is the introduction to, Young Lust.
Yeah. That whole three song run. And Empty Spaces, Young Lust, One of My Turns. One of My Turns, probably my favorite song in the album. Amazing. But yeah, on to probably some more prog here.
I wouldn't call this one prog as much.
It's from a prog band.
Yeah.
They were prog at one point.
They were prog before this, but Owner of a Lonely Heart.
No, I'm kidding. Full of jokes here. Anyway, yeah, I like this song. Very quintessential 80s kind of one-hit wonder. But apparently, we were talking about it earlier in the show, they have more stuff than just that.
This is, sure. We'll call it that. They are one of the more influential, I think, prog bands out there. The album was a Close to the Edge. That's my favorite by them. It's one of those prog albums where it's like one song is an entire album side, so you know it's good.
Yeah, I just recently got that.
Really?
I just got that recently from a record store day.
Oh, that's awesome.
But I was able to pick that up for like $12.
That's a good deal.
But Close to the Edge is 18 minutes, so it's like an entire first side of the album. And then there's two songs on the other side, and then that's the album.
The 80s were not a good time for a lot of prog bands. I mean, this obviously financially speaking, they kind of they did well. I mean, this is definitely not nearly anywhere as like complex or like instrumentally.
I had no idea they
detailed.
I'm being like 100% serious, like because we talked about it earlier. I did not know they did anything like other than like the album that Owner of a Lonely Heart is on.
That breaks my heart to hear that. But
Relayer. There's Tales of Topographic Oceans. That's another almost hour and a half album. That's only four songs.
This is
good.
Okay.
Each song is 20 minutes.
Let's cut to the chase. What album number is whatever album this is?
I am not sure, but it was in their switch from like their 70s kind of prog folk jazz fusion esque influenced sound into kind of the 80s, like trying to keep up with all the effects.
So they probably have like a decent number of albums before this one, right?
Definitely. Yeah. Most of their good albums, I think, are before this one. But
that's yeah.
Well, I learned something new today.
Yeah.
Very good band. Very interesting band. Let's take it a step past this one. This is a song that I don't have words for, so I'm going to let you talk about this one here.
Submarine Races?
By Jan and Dean.
Yeah.
This is... Well, it's not really a song. Well, it's a song, but it's like not like
it's
basically
more of a skit.
Another good April Fool's kind of jokey kind of thing. The whole entire joke here was that, you know, the narrator is trying to, you know, come up with an excuse that he's telling his teacher, and he's like, you know, my baby doesn't like fancy places. She just wants to go to the submarine races, and some guy's like, Hey,
I like submarines.
Yeah, let me go with you. I'd love to look out your window if I could.
I'd call you handsome. I'd smile too if I saw you.
Yeah, and it's like no. It's just an excuse. An excuse? What? You know? And it's like, we just go down to Chautauqua, and then we park. You park. And
I would
back. Yeah, I'll be quiet. I'll let you glue on my conning tower.
Well, you know, I'd say that I'd say people go home and listen to it, but I think that you basically just gave them the whole skit now.
Yeah, probably.
So there's nothing left for them to hear.
But it is it is funny because it's just like the whole time there's just a 60s like
a backing track. Yeah.
It was a different time. Yeah. You could just put that on an album and everybody would have to live with it.
Yeah, going on with the whole Sea thing, we got Sea Cruise by Frankie Ford. It's another one of those 50s songs that sounds a little bit different, especially with the ringing the bell and the whole boat horn and all that stuff. It's pretty good.
Atmospheric.
With more yacht rock, we got more yacht rock, right,
Simon? I wouldn't call the one before this yacht rock, but this one is definitely one of the most, I don't want to say there's like a trinity of yacht rock albums, because I can't name two other ones, but like this is definitely one of the more well-known yacht rock albums, which is Sailing by Christopher Cross.
I'm trying not to interrupt.
No, you're good. This song is, what's this, Minstrel Gigolo, which is, I have no idea what the meaning of that is, but I did listen to this whole album a couple days ago because I watched this documentary they had on HBO Max that was just about yacht rock, and I learned like the horror that the entirety of like late 70s, early 80s pop music and everything that has descended from that can trace its origins back to the band Steely Dan and the group of session musicians surrounding them. So like you break off from them, you go to like, was his name Michael McDonald? He made the band, you know, he was in the Doobie Brothers. That guy breaks off. There's people in that band who are different bands. All of the band Africa
it's a big family
Steely
tree.
Dan. No, it's a bush. It's not a tree. It's a bush. It's like everybody's interconnected. Michael Jackson is connected to it for some reason. It like bounces off into like, no, I'm not even kidding you. They had like in the show, they had like a giant diagram of like albums with like arrows going between them to show like everybody who's like played on one album plays another one. The like Michael Jackson Thriller, the song Human Nature was written by the people in Toto, and like that was connected to yacht rock. And then like there's like a Michael McDonald song that got sampled by like it was like an early like G-funk artist, so that whole scene is connected to yacht rock, which is connected to Steely Dan. And like you start diving into it, it's all
I'm just seeing I feel like I'm
a crazy person right now. I'm like standing in front of my giant like board with a ton of like
talking, or you're talking to
you know
a
what I mean
wall?
Like no, like there's like the wall with like all of like the papers with like the pins with the strings between them, and I'm like ranting at like this the audience right now, but like that's what's happening right now. I swear you need to look into this. It goes deeper than you could possibly imagine. Like the yacht rock mafia, they control music. It's terrifying.
And then it also has its tendrils in the prog scene as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's scary. I don't know. I don't probably somewhere.
I mean, because Bill Bruford also. I mean, he was on Yes's stuff, earlier stuff, but then he also filled in for Genesis when Peter Gabriel was leaving.
And he was King Crimson too, right?
Yeah, he was in King Crimson too. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, this is getting a bit.
Okay, yeah,
much.
We're getting a little off topic here.
No, sorry. Just next, finish this thought. Yeah. No, I want to know where this is going before we keep going.
I don't know. It was just you know the whole mafia.
Prog rock. Everybody hangs out with everybody. Yeah, it's terrifying. Next. All of music can be traced back to either Steely Dan or King Crimson. That's the truth.
Next up,
I'm sorry, that was a lot.
Okay, so you aren't going to believe me when I say this, but like, look it up. But this is Chuck Berry's only number one Hot 100 hit. Not R&B, they're Hot 100. Hmm. And the song is called...
You know,
and that's what the song is, because it's...
Ding? What?
Yeah. No, I'm censoring it because
the song's called My Ding-a-ling.
Yeah,
you can say that.
Yeah,
you can say that.
I know I can say it.
They played it on the radio.
I'm trying to be funny. I mean, they played it on. I'm trying to be funny, but
it got to number one.
That is true. Yeah, it got to number one, and it's not about that technically. Technically, it's about a toy that he got from his grandma that's just strings and some bells on it. He likes it a whole awful lot.
And nobody has ever put any double meaning in music ever, certainly not Chuck Berry.
Never.
This I'm just in awe that this is the only song that he's ever done is a number one hit.
Like Sweet Little 16 hit number two on the Hot 100. I'm sure he had like a bunch of number ones on the R&B
charts probably,
in the 50s, but it was like, you know, segregation in the 50s and stuff kind of like put a real giant dampener where artists could go on the Hot 100.
Yeah, like a lot of like the early rock early rock classes you think of, like they didn't even like hit the Hot 100 until like white artists were covering them, you know, like. Mm-hmm.
Elvis half, you know, or the Colonel, I should say. Buying half the rights to songs and stuff like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And at least he made it eventually, and that's...
Yeah.
Even if the song's a little bit... Maybe not the one that deserved it the most, it's good that he got the honor at least one time. I think that's a good thing, I guess.
Another 50s-related skew is Hushabye by The Mystics, which is quite a good song. It was on Stand By Me, which is a great movie.
I've never seen it, but... I think we skipped over one. Did you want to talk about Tarkus real quick?
Yeah. You guys have a thing with ELP. You guys don't like them too much.
We had to play the song Carnival 9 in band class, and it was a pain.
It over and over.
The song was like, I had to play the cymbals, and the whole thing was basically just quarter notes. So I was like, the whole time, crash.
I don't remember
much. It was very tiring.
I am 99% sure I've blocked all that, like the Carnival 9 stuff from my memory.
Good thing we're not talking about Carnival 9.
No, this
we're
is
talking
a Tarkus.
About Tarkus, yes. And we didn't play the whole 20-minute thing.
You played Eruption.
Yeah, we played the first movement, which was Eruption, which is just this cool, like, it was 5/8 of, like, organ line that Keith Emerson does. Greg Lake is following that on the bass, just all fourths, so he's staying on the same fret going up and down the strings.
Jeez.
It's crazy. But really cool stuff.
And you mentioned the Prog Rock Mafia earlier. I have to mention that Greg Lake was the lead singer of King Crimson before he was in Emerson, Lake & Palmer, so add another string for that.
I didn't know that.
Carl Palmer.
He sings.
I thought they were just like some band formed with some random guys, like the Beatles, like where it was like, four guys like met and they played stuff together. I thought this was
all
just
three
like
of these
three
guys like,
that I didn't know they were in stuff beforehand.
They were all in different prog bands before this, right?
I'm not too sure about Keith Emerson, but Carl Palmer, at least my dad saw him play with Asia, and he did this like really cool drum solo where the riser came out.
Tons of yacht rock,
Asia
and all this stuff.
Well, Asia's like the big prog super group. Like, not they're not even a prog band, but like all of the people in that band were super like influential prog bands, and then they made.
Okay, we should
that
talk,
album.
You could talk about this on its own kind of.
We could do a prog rock. I'd love to do a prog rock episode.
No, I mean like the prog rock mafia thing.
We can't talk about it too much because then they'll come get us.
Do we have any others? I think I might have skipped some, or is it Psychotic Reaction?
No, we didn't skip
that one.
Okay,
no, that's a good song.
I liked it. It's a '60s song that I kind of like that Tim brought in.
Yeah, garage rock, something like that. It was interesting.
Next up.
All the Young Dudes by Mott the Hoople. I don't know what the band name came from, but it's an interesting name for a band.
It's from a book.
Sure.
Pretty sure.
I would believe that.
I think I looked it up.
Yeah. And this is actually
like from some character of a book or something.
Something like that. I don't know. This song is actually written by David Bowie, which is interesting. I thought, when you listen to it,
it's a very David Bowie song.
Yeah, it sounds like a David Bowie song.
Yeah.
Like the delivery of it, at least, and like the instrumental, I guess. It would have fit on Ziggy Stardust, I think. Nobody would have like said anything about it, I guess.
Right.
But moving after that, we have just a little song called Search by the Minutemen, which is fun because that band definitely lives up to its name in that I feel like this song particularly is literally 50 seconds long, so it's not even a full minute. So that's a good band.
Oh, yeah.
That's the one that gets brought in a lot, quite a bit. And it's always fun when they bring it in because,
Steve.
Someone's going to have to run up and put something on right after because it's only a minute long.
Yeah, speaking of running, there's a song about driving next, Beep Beep by the Playmates. It's this guy in this Cadillac is driving down the road. There's this little Nash Rambler that pulls up right behind him, and he's like tailgating this guy. And it's just the song kind of starts out slow, and then it gets faster and 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 faster. Yeah, like literally super fast, very fast.
I have nothing to say about this. This is terrifying me. But
yeah, it was one of the first 45s I ever bought.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Then we got Concrete and Clay from the Rushmore. Great movie. Wes Anderson movie. It's got like a very like lots of 60s kind of music in it.
Yeah.
He always does that. He's always finding weird 60s music to throw into his movies, I have to say.
Yeah. Next, we've got a certain.
We've got two big hit songs, one of which is a one hit, one of which is a million hit, but
a billion.
Billion, sorry.
Spotify, over a billion.
Stayin' Alive by the Bee Gees and then Take On Me by Aha. And we'll have to say right now, Stayin' Alive, They Can Never Make Me Hate You. This is a beautiful song.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I know it's one of those like songs where like you can do CPR to it. If I'm ever like having a heart attack, that's the one I want them to play.
The Office.
Right. And then, good song.
Yeah.
Very.
Also, speaking of the Bee Gees and all that stuff, with your Law and Order, you were saying, I don't know how A Night on Disco Mountain relates to crime. The crime is that Tony and Double J and all them were climbing on the Verzano Bridge, the Staten Island Bridge.
So
that's the crime.
Okay, well,
anyway,
bring that back.
Take On Me.
This is a song. Yeah,
that was a popular, like,
I think the music video is really awesome. This song was like a big, big meme song back when I was in high school.
Yeah.
I remember that was everywhere. It's
Marlon
fine.
Webb and stuff
it's
like
a,
that.
It's a very upbeat song.
We played it for marching band.
Me too.
It was pretty fun.
We did?
once.
But actually, this one, you know, being as massive of a hit it is, I do, and you know, it hits, they can get kind of tiring to listen to when they just kind of show up in the wild. It's like, I'm really tired of hearing this song over and over and over again. But when you come into Record Club, it does kind of put it in a slightly different context. You're in more of a mind state to kind of appreciate the actual good songwriting underneath a hit like that. And there is really good songwriting underneath the song Take On Me. You know, aside from being just as popular as it was, it's still a good song.
Like, I mean, yeah, you trash the song, the songs like this all you want. I mean, like, there's a reason that it was as big as it was, is that it was able to connect to a lot of people, you know. It's very catchy. Like, you can't get, like I said, it's one of the songs you just can't get away from once you hear it.
Yeah.
Definitely a lot of these, like, one-hit wonder songs, but especially this one, I'd have to say.
Yeah. And it might be annoying in the grocery store, but, you know, you sit at home and you actually turn it on.
It's a difference between wanting to hear it and not wanting to hear it.
Speaking of grocery stores and Take On Me, it was also in that Family Guy episode, you know, where the hand comes out of the milk and,
that's like the actual music video,
Chris,
I think.
You know, and he gets brought in to the whole thing.
Yeah, they do, it's like, that's literally the actual music video of it, yeah. Too. That's the thing. Really cool music video, by the way. Go watch if you haven't seen that one.
Yeah, definitely check that.
Definitely
out.
Very cool music video. But I think that's the end of the playlist though today.
Yeah.
A lot of good, interesting one hit wonders. Some not one hit wonders, but definitely hits.
Yeah,
definitely a lot of that.
Moments in
but
the
spotlight.
But
that's the whole joke. It's like, oh, this band's one of the best known bands in the world. Let's play their number one song.
Exactly. Very good. But if you're interested at all in coming into any more meetings though, and seeing what other interesting music will get played there. You can check out our website, which will be linked with the show. There you'll find our meeting schedule, any playlists we make, any past podcasts, as well as any themes for the future meetings we're going to be doing. Everybody's welcome at the Record Club. Like we said, you know, the only barrier to joining is that you have to be willing to hear some music that you wouldn't normally listen to, as this episode's probably demonstrated. And you just have to have, you know, a general appreciation for music. Whether you have no records at all or you've been collecting for decades, we're a very friendly group. We accept all kinds of music. We love to hear what you have to bring in. Thank you for tuning in. We'll hope you see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.
Love you too.
Bye.
Sharing the voices of Lansing Community College. Visit us at lccconnect.org.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Aloha. I'm Ben Hassinger, Michigan's ukulele ambassador and founder of Mighty Uke Day, a celebration of the diminutive yet dynamic ukulele. This year, we'll be kicking things off with a special fundraiser on Saturday, April 11th at the Sir Pizza Old Town Pub. The day begins with our monthly morning meeting of Laugh, the Lansing Area Ukulele Group, followed by concerts, group strums, open mic, a silent auction, and plenty of ukulele fun. Scheduled performers include the Ukulele Kings, Vinyl Resting Place, the PT Strummers, and others to be announced. We'll also be recording the Mighty Uke Day 16 theme song for a viral video release. Join us for this celebration of strumming and singing, Saturday, April 11th at the Sir Pizza Old Town Pub. Proceeds for the Mighty Uke Day benefit the nonprofit Music is the Foundation. For more information and advanced tickets, visit MightyUkeDay.com. That's MightyUkeDay.com.
Lansing Community College's Business and Community Institute provides businesses with customized, synergistic trainings that realize logistical opportunity. Learn more about the future of business today at lcc.edu/BCI.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Hello there, this is Terry Denise, a Lansing Community College student and your host of Ripper, an LCC Connect podcast where I interview others and ask about their unique efforts and connections in, around, and beyond the community of Michigan's capital city.
Vamp 3, part 3. Now it's part 3. We have been talking about Nosferatu and vampires in general and Dracula. This is Terry Denise along with Brendan. Hi, Brendan.
Hi.
we're on a blood-sucking campaign right now, basically, right? We are. So I believe last we were speaking on how Abrahamic religious figures had interspersed and evolved into different kinds of Dracula stories that we've seen displayed on screen. There was a Dracula movie, I remember, where it wasn't Jesus, it was the Judas Iscariot, was in one of these films, it was Judas Iscariot became the first vampire. So it was his quest to do whatever he needed to do in that film. It was like when he got the silver, he went to go hang himself and he was given an ability to come back alive, I believe. That's what the, or it was, maybe it was even that he couldn't even die or something, where that became his consequence for turning his back on Jesus for silver.
Eternal damnation.
Eternal life, but through another way.
Right.
But in with that, though, you've got these stories about, you know, people take the sacrament all the time, which is of the blood. Blood is the life, once again. And the flesh being of the body of Christ, which is very interesting. And then you put that into like the realm of vampires and it makes for good entertainment. It might be, I don't know, for some that's not such a good thing, but I think that's a great area for a lot of writers to take their own way of turning those stories into each other. You start to run out of ideas after a while. You can only stake so many undead beings, and you got to have some new ways.
Stake so many hearts.
Yeah, you got to have some new ways of looking at this stuff. So Count Orlok of Robert Eggers' version, and I believe that was through A24, right? The studios?
I believe so.
Okay. You see a very specific style in how he creates. He's got a lot of slow moving pacings, a lot of the camera movements. It's not even though that they're so slow, it's just that sometimes they're just slightly off. Like things are slightly askewed in a very beautiful way, though. It's not so weird that it makes you like, this is a horror film. We've got our Dutch angles over here and, you know, everybody's running everywhere. It's like, nope. It's actually the opposite of that, where you do get those fast turns every once in a while, but he uses them sparingly, purposefully.
Yeah, definitely. Even. Very subtle. He's got a light touch.
So when we do see in this film where we have the story of this Cossack soldier who sold, or if you kind of like Judas Iscariot in that other Dracula movie, where he is given this option, or he goes for himself to become this supernatural creature that after being a soldier, he's just like, I still want blood. I still want more, even after death. So that's kind of basically his storyline. The Cossacks were around the region of Russia.
Yeah, it was like in the Ukrainian steppes.
Yeah, exactly. Eastern Christian people, East Slavic.
East meets West.
Right. And you can see that even in the costuming and in the hair design, the hairdressing and the makeup. You see that it is an old Cossack soldier in the hat and even in the facial hair, which we saw a lot of, which for some, I guess, was a controversial thing with the mustache. Which I thought the mustache looked great. I thought the blood coming off of the mustache was especially amazing, the effects that they did with that. But what we're seeing is an undead creature. So this isn't a human. This isn't just a soldier of that time or anything. This is this re-emerging being that used to look like something else that kind of looks similar to what we see in the film. But this is just its dead version of itself. And you see all these like holes in its skin. You see all of this, like all these warped areas. And you see this parted hair that's stringy and disgusting looking. You see the skin is like falling off. But you also get this weird mustache. But I guess at the time, Brendan, if you can, you have some information on facial hair lot during the time of plague. And it wasn't just for stylistic, like cosmetic.
As internal medicine started to become more of a known thing, especially like contamination and how germs spread, that was like a big thing that changed with dressing patterns and like, you know, fashion styles, you know, facial hair just kind of started to go out of fashion, mm-hmm. Because, you know, we started to understand how it was, you know, harbingers for disease, the whole Victorian mindset of, you know, everything proper and in its place. Mm-hmm. There's a status quo to things, you know, a natural order that you have to adhere to. But it's all an element of not necessarily being chaste, but like it's almost ignoring the fact that our bodies like sweat and produce chemicals and that we have, you know, urges, feelings, mm-hmm. all that's very gross.
Mm. So interesting with then this being a facial hair and then right. also
it's also a sign of virility for someone who's undead. He sure has a pretty thick mustache.
That is weird. Yeah, because it is said that parts of you still grow after death. You're even, right. So
your hair and your fingernails, which he still has.
Many were, you know, this was a time of an emergence of psychological health. And
yeah, sure.
So we've got, you know, Freudian soon to come. Right. And then we've got Darwin and all these other anthropological, biological scientists and researchers. Mm. But then we go into this mode where people took advantage of that to then suppress other people, to scapegoat other people, to say yeah, that sure. you are not as good as me. I am much better than you. Look at my facial hair. So doesn't my facial hair tell you anything about who I am? Mm-hmm. Which then brings about this monster and this creature being the superior to all of the rest of these people that are saying, no, wait, no, you can't do that. But you can't be that being. You can't be better than me. You can't take over us all. And it almost, it's kind of flipping people on their behinds in a sense where it's just like, who cares about your silly haircuts? And this is, you know, I am a disease that's going to eat you alive. Literally, I am eating you to death. What are you going to do about it? I am beyond you. I'm a supernatural being. I have gone to the depths beyond what you think a hell is. And you have no idea what the name of where I have been. Like, you don't have a say over what I do. But, oh no, this little one does. This young female creature does all of a sudden. And then the light into the darkness, darkness into the light, and then vanished. Both the female protagonists of Ellen and our creature Count Orlok all of a sudden vanish with their bond that gets created. And that starts out from when she's quite young, when she is a virgin herself. So you get this like weird, like it's not overtly religious at all. This is not what this discussion is about, but there are these overtones because we're human, because we've lived in this Eastern Western world of cultures, that there are these elements that are in play in this entire story. I mean, one of the things about vampires is that, you know, they can't stand crucifixes or anything like that. But if you listen to Bill Hicks, I don't think Jesus Christ would like a crucifix either. If he, Bill Hicks, a beloved late comedian, had mentioned that Christ would probably not want to see the thing that he died on all of the time. It's just like, what is that? Why are you wearing the thing that I died upon? Right. Like all the time. I just thought that was a
you
very
wore that today.
It's just a very funny thing. But to then come to this point where in these kinds of stories and this film in particular, where you're draining this idea of what it means to be beyond, to have an everlasting life and beyond that. And it's like, well, what did you do? I'm the one that sat up in church all the day. And yeah, Orlok's not. Well, I didn't. And I'm here. So what do you want? You know, like, but the only thing that can tame him, as the shrew he becomes, the only thing that seems to be able to tame him is this idea of love and this light. But onto another topic, just being the lighting that is in this film in and of itself from the beginning, where we do see Ellen as a child when she's beckoning towards some angel. She actually thinks she does say an angel. Mm. I want an angel to come protect me and be with me, and I want to love you and all this kind of stuff. When we see her in the nighttime saying this to a full moon, we don't see the light of, we don't see the moon at all. Mm-hmm. The moon is above the line of the screen. Mm-hmm. all we see is this weird light that's coming down. It's like, where's that coming from? Which also gave me that like theatrical stage lighting. I'm like, ooh, mm-hmm. Eggers at play here. I like it. Mm-hmm. You know, very, very nerd theater.
Oh, no, definitely. On. Like, I definitely read some things where he was talking about they specifically used certain color of lights, but also certain filters on the camera to achieve that a very specific nighttime look. They almost wanted it to be completely desaturated to almost have a black and white look.
Yep.
But I feel like it's some of the best low light cinematography you're going to find today.
Yeah.
It's dark. Uh-huh. I know that that's a big thing that, you know, cinematographers get a kick out of these days is like, how dark can they make it?
Yep.
But you can still see with great definition, and it's done with a sense of artistry. There's a reason that it, just as you're saying, mm-hmm. you don't see where this light is emanating from.
Right. You hear something.
Right.
You keep hearing these whispers and a shadow. Right. Even mm-hmm. you can hear a shadow.
The abyss is out there.
Dude. What?
She's waiting.
I had no idea about that, that he used a specific kind of filter. That darkness, by the way, it looks like a real midnight. It looks like that Definitely. Midnight blue that you see Definitely. In the sky. So he did a really good job at that, the cinematographer as well. Mm-hmm. And it just being this off, this point of focus that is not in focus adds into that psychological like play of where is this voice coming from? Mm-hmm. And I mean, you can hear it when you're in the theater or when you're watching it. The way that that plays into you psychologically is like you hear something. It feels like it's behind you, mm-hmm. but you're not seeing anything. Just like you said, that mm-hmm. is taking, it's a strange misdirect, which he does a bit of in this film. Again, with the timing issue, there's like this misdirection of that. If you don't know the story of Nosferatu, you think that Hutter is going to come and save his wife mm. from death, from this eventual creature that's, he's going to get there in time and then the creature's going to die and blah, 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 blah. But this story is, the Nosferatu story is different from the Dracula story. In the Dracula story, Mina lives with Harker.
It's Canary. Yeah, right, right.
Keanu Reeves, yes.
Yeah, just Keanu Reeves.
All the time, Keanu. But Harker, Jonathan Harker, is, he ends up coming, well, actually, Mina saves herself, essentially. She kills the vampire, and then she goes back to her husband, and Harker's alive. In the Nosferatu version, Hutter is late again. Mm. Or he might be on time, actually. I cannot remember the last, but I know that there's a pull on the clock.
Yeah, definitely.
And I can't remember the last ticking, but I think it's made to be the point of, it was like a callback to him being late in the beginning. And I think he is on time in the end.
No, sure.
But he's just not on time enough for her because she had to do what she had to do. But she was also, you know, she was full of some kind of sickness herself, I guess you could say. And she didn't see, I thought maybe she didn't see herself pulling through in the way that she would want to be this ever-loving creature towards her own husband of Hutter. Mm. And that maybe that is this like weird Orlok being this older predator coming after a child from beyond, like as a shadow, as a whisper, and he's got the creeper mustache, which, you know, for of the time period of when he had died, that's what he died with. So we see that. But it's like, was Eggers, you know, was he alluding to the movement of like Me Too? Was he alluding to the industry, the film industry in and of itself? You've got Lily Depp Rose, who is the daughter of Johnny Depp. And you've got these older players. You've got Willem Dafoe in there. You've got, you know, people that have been on screen for a very long time. And then you've got a next generation from this older generation that has come in. So it's just kind of like this weird, like, there's a safety thing going on here where you've got Willem Dafoe's character who plays the scholar mm-hmm. who comes to, and he's got all this information on what Nosferatu is and this creature from beyond and has studied the supernatural and whatnot. So with that, though, we kind of wonder, it's just like there is this kind of safety among other people here, but everybody keeps dying off around you. So it's just like, is she finding comfort then in this creature? Does she become like kind of a Stockholm syndrome, where it's just like adapt to.
Right. You see the side of your captors as being positive. Your side.
Right. I mean, in her beginning is beckoning to this creature in the first place and allowing this and allowing herself. But at the same time, it's like he's a creature, though. Even our innocence, where there is a draw, so to speak, a drawing of the innocent blood.
You're right.
There is a lot of that, too. There's we see children die in this film.
Mm, you're right.
Which is different.
Again, a very modern horror thing. You actually see kids in heavy horror films, which is something you would never see. Mm-hmm. There are heavy implications in many of the side characters, let alone our main characters.
Right.
In this story. And again, all of it is definitely speaking towards our modern zeitgeist of gender dynamics, hierarchy, the sense of power struggle, how all of this means to the individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because Ellen technically is hysterical, is what it was called at the time, which is that word in and of itself alluding to our bodies and our reproductive organs. And it is literally alluding to like being your own hormones, your hormones. And you're right. Crazy. And it's not just that she's like going through stuff because she maybe lost her mom as a child and had this weird mental thing that happened to her as a result. She'd had PTSD of her own. And maybe she's just dealing with a bunch. I don't know. She just got married. She's, you know, she's got a lot she's got to deal with. She's trying to build a household and get plates, decorative plates.
Yeah, I was trying to think of. Almost all the other characters are all like old men.
Yep. And or unless they're their husbands.
Right. But none of the men have any of the answers. Even our ancient occult scholar.
Right.
It's not until the end that he realizes what the answer is. And he didn't even provide it.
Nope.
She did.
That's again with that masculinity throughout the film running through a whole thread of consistently asking about Hutter and when is he moving into another house and or how their household is going, how he's getting a new job and a higher paid job and whatnot and going out to these older gentlemen that he works for and still being like this, oh yeah, I'm sorry I'm late today, blah, 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 you know, down to Orlok himself and coming to this, you said, this ancient beyond creature who himself was old world versus new world, kind of a sense of where it's just maybe this is another play on an evolution in masculinity in of itself. Mm. And that being an interesting story of Nosferatu, where it is this like this old world that has already died off and it's trying to relive again. Mm. And it's just like, no, dude, like we're done. Like you gotta go. This weird notion that you have of this form of love, maybe even a genderized love, maybe we need to expand our ability to see the way that we can forever love another. Not going into her being a child, not staying away from that. That's not where I'm going with this. Mm. But in the essence of that, in consensual adult relationships, being of that romantic value of like, is my husband good enough for me? You're not, you know, you're not mature enough or something, you know? And that's when she goes into like the plates and like she wants these things and they have their like first argument and it's, we see them as a newlywed couple and it's that, well, that's, you know, you guys are newlyweds. That's, you're supposed to get into things, you know? You're two beings come together and it's not just being husband and wife, it's just you're another person to another person and you're in another person's space and there's this other creature that's trying to edge itself into both of your spaces. And like you're saying, like this is a point where Hutter comes into his masculinity himself.
Right.
But it's not even being a man necessarily. It's just like, no, it's my love for this other person.
Finding his own confidence, right.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Just a little too late.
Yeah. And the thing with our creature, Count Orlok, you mentioned the search for love in one of the first episodes, and it's almost like he doesn't understand that he's a narcissistic creature.
Mm.
Everything is about him. So the point being made at the end, as you had mentioned, is that Ellen being the point of his end. She's the only one that could end him because he himself only probably went into the dark arts because he was still searching for something.
Sure.
He was still looking for that thing that he couldn't find while he was alive and while he was killing and blah, 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 or whatever he was doing. Looking for that one piece of thing, ironically going so dark through hell, through the scapes of the dark arts and into like other dimensions and whatever he did to do and become what he becomes. This distant whisper that you don't see, there's no light that shines upon him typically until he dies in the light.
Mm-hmm.
So him reaching through the darkness to only find the light, it's like, duh, the only sight of you that you were looking for was this light, this creature of love and light. The fact that you couldn't put that together, that this hysterical, crazy female is the only one in the end, which is the only pinnacle point for every single one of those characters, losing your light, losing your love, losing the children even. Mm. The fact that this comes out during the Christmas, during the darkest point of the year, and that it takes place in the film during the darkest point and darkest time, the shortest time of light for the Northern Hemisphere, at least, that being an interesting detail where it's just like this dark creature's timing. It can stay out for as long as it needs to, except for these few hours without dying. The fact that, like, yeah, he also misses his timing. That's a weird thing. Okay, let me bring it back here. I do like the fact that Willem Dafoe and Johnny Depp, the fact that those two, Johnny Depp, one of his first films was with Willem Dafoe in Platoon.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have this other sense of beyond just the screenplay, this other sense of Hollywood in and of itself, and the protagonist being a female, and the sense that Hollywood wants more female protagonists to lead the way. Interesting enough, when talking about this fear of emasculation, we have these parallel real life instances that are going on with the Me Too movement, with Hollywood in and of itself, and this like fear of emasculation within Hollywood. Like, no, I want to treat you the way I want to treat you. You can't get this part unless you do this thing because I'm a man or whatever. And then with Lily Rose Depp being a progeny of an already established male lead, a male actor that we've seen in so many different films. So Lily Rose Depp, at her young age, working with her father's co-worker and co-player in a different film when they were that young age. It's just very interesting to see like this older male that's just, you're safe. Even in the movie, the scary creature, this disgusting, gross male, like, gross, nasty, I'm going to eat you alive creature with that background of Hollywood being this, like, we're going to eat you. You're going to eat our young. We're going to eat our stars alive. And then you got, like, Willem Dafoe that's just like, hey, what's up? Like, you're safe with me. And, like, you know, he knows her father and worked with her father when he was young as well. I just thought that was a very interesting thing and wondered if, because she is nude in the film, which is very interesting because it's almost like if I were Johnny Depp, I'd be like, who's touching my daughter and who's seeing her like on this film set when we've already got problems going on in Hollywood? It would be one of those things where it's just like, comfort level, you know, we've got therapists on stuff. There's
intimacy coordinators.
Yes, thank you. That handle certain aspects of where to stop, where does it another actor feel comfortable? Where they do they not feel uncomfortable? And we are going to have this conversation before we even read the script, kind of a thing.
Yeah, definitely.
So to have those things now in modern day brings about this whole thing where it's just like with Ellen, played by Lily Rose Depp, how she herself as that character breaks down this notion of whether it is over masculinity or emasculation. It's just like breaking down all of that crap and just being like, well, what I'm going to do as this character is, yeah, I'm going to do everything I want to do. I'm going to feel comfortable doing it. And I'm also going to like kill everybody. And then I'm going to let myself die in the arms of this disgusting beast creature. So what do you want? You know, it's just like, all right. Like, I'm going to die in the most beautiful way with this most disgusting, ew, ick kind of creature. And then it's almost parallel to, like, this old guard, old world.
It's as if it was her destiny.
interesting, right? This old world of maybe even Hollywood in of itself being killed off. It's like, we still love you, Hollywood, but we're going to do something new. We're moving on. And you're coming with us, right, in a sense, but that stuff, that's got to die.
The times, they are a-changing.
The disgusting old creature has got to die.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to kill you off, and we'll do it in this most beautiful way, which is almost weird because it's like, oh, maybe I guess I was touching on that a little bit. There was tons of flowers. It was a beautiful funeral,
mm-hmm,
I have to say.
But, nice early morning golden hour.
Yes.
Magic hour.
I know, right? Well, here we go. We're going to go out into the cold pretty soon here. I'm sure we're going to talk much more about monsters and whatnot. We've got...
I mean, it is the season.
Tis the season indeed. Watch out for those full moons out there, I'd say. Maybe just watch out for the ones with blood dripping off their... Not so much the pencil mustache, but maybe just the blood dripping off the mustache in and of itself.
Yeah,
and
it's probably a...
telltale sign.
Right, that's a cue you should pay attention to.
All right. Brendan, thank you so much for joining me.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
All right. I'll be back with more soon for other discussions. This is Ripper, and thanks for joining me. I'm Terry Denise. Bye. Thanks for tuning in to Ripper. You can find more about this and other LCC Connect podcasts at lccconnect.com.
This has been a presentation of LCC Connect, a weekly program that features the voices, vibes, and vision of Lansing Community College. All shows featured on LCC Connect are recorded at the WLNZ studio, located on LCC's downtown campus. Each program is podcast-based and can be heard anytime at lccconnect.org. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on one of our shows, connect with us by emailing lcc-connect@lcc.edu.